attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we tricked all our customers onto a boat, rowed them out to a remote and rocky island, and left them there, all just to win the attention of Adam Ferrier, author of Stop Listening to Your Customers and all-round brand Brainbox. A thoroughly compelling advocate against the idea of customer obsession, Adam reckons that it's the source of much of the blobbish brand blandness that's all around us. As well as sharing the theory in his excellent books, which also include The Advertising Effect, How to Change Behavior, Adam is the founder of Thinkabell, an agency that blends marketing science with creative thinking to produce what they describe as measured magic. Part brand strategist, part consumer psychologist, part talker of enormous sense, Adam is on a mission to find that elusive balance between what the customer needs and what brands should be. Adam says, rather than listening to the consumer, try hearing your brand instead. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you. That was quite the intro. That's quite cool listening to that.
Nice. We'll take quite cool. Seven quick fires, Adam. Melbourne or Perth?
Melbourne, 100%. With all due respect to Perth.
Number two, Monopoly or The Analyst?
The Analyst.
Nice. We'll hopefully talk about that a bit later. Best film, Breakfast Club or The Last Supper?
Oh, gosh, I was going to say The Breakfast Club because nothing beats it, but The Last Supper beats it.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
Favorite meal-based film title. Love it. Right. This is unfair, but we're asking it anyway. Asterix or Obelix?
I thought you were going to say Asterix or Arturo, who's my other son, but definitely...
No.
That would be a very cruel warm-up exercise. Which one do you prefer? But I'll take Asterix over Obelix any day.
Good stuff. Well, we do risk upsetting at least half your agency with this one. Thinkers or Tinkers?
Ooh. So Thinkers are strategy suity types. Thinkers are creative production-y types. The blend of both is perfect.
Good stuff. Right, we've got two more. Salience or meaning?
Salience trumps meaning, even though I'd like it to be the other way around.
Nice, nice. Okay, last one, The Green Mile or Shawshank Redemption?
The Green Mile, is that based on a Stephen King book?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
Yeah, I'll say that for that reason. And also because The Shawshank Redemption is just a load of utter shit. It's one of the most unenjoyable films I've ever seen.
That's two good reasons. Awesome, okay. Nice one. Well, thanks, Adam. Thanks for joining us. We always start the episode by trying to bust the myth that there's a correct route into the industry or the creative world, I suppose, broadly speaking. So can you start by sharing a bit about your first ever jobs and your first what you regard to be proper marketing job?
Yeah. So I used to play the share market at school. During lunchtime, I used to ring up my stockbroker, trade shares, and then go back to class. It was kind of weird and odd, and I was failing school at the time, and so I had to go see a tutor. The tutor said, what are your interests? And I said, money and people. And he said, I should become a consumer psychologist, and I thought, perfect. That's exactly what I want to be. And it's one of those only times where I've ever heard a careers counselor actually get it right. I also used to just, my sister's was in advertising. I used to look at her D&AD annuals, a big kind, and just used to love looking at all the brands and how the brands communicated. And so I've always had this kind of fascination with the power the brands have and that they can make you kind of, you know, choose one thing over another, even though it's completely ridiculous as to why you're choosing that thing. So I kind of always wanted to get into that world, but graduating uni with degrees in commerce and psychology. I took a job where I could get one, which was in the prison system as a young psychologist. And I did that so I could get trained, I could get my supervision so I could become a proper registered psychologist. And, you know, who's not interested in forensic psychology? It's pretty cool. So I did that for a while. And at the same time, I started doing work with Relationships Australia, which and looking at domestic violence issues with men. And so there was a whole lot of really interesting stuff that just kind of sucked me into the world of psychology. And then I thought, shit, if I'm going to do this consumer psychology stuff, I need to get serious about making a bit of a career change. This is after about 6 years or so in the prison system. So I did my thesis in clinical psychology on what makes people cool, or more specifically, the underlying constructs of cool people. And I did that so I could swing my attention from the forensic setting into a consumer or marketing setting. And, you know, and that worked. And I was a cool hunter, which is embarrassing and stupid. But so psychology, it's not a million miles away from what we do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a point that's come up a few times, and you know, it'd be wrong for me not to nod to the likes of Mark Earls and Rory Sutherland, who I think probably has popularized it even more since Mark.
Just on that point, though, one of the things I hate is everyone says, oh, yeah, they've studied psychology, and everyone talks about, like, psychology was everyone's second choice at uni. They did what they did, and then everyone did a bit of psychology. So everyone says, oh, yeah, I've studied psychology, but there's a bit of a difference between studying psychology and slogging it out for 7 years and getting registered and doing your master's and all of that kind of shit. So I am a champion for either you're a psychologist or you're not. And if you're not, don't pretend you
yes.
are.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, no, I can completely understand that. And it's very fair to say that. I think the point being that the idea that marketers and advertising folks shouldn't be interested in human behavior is just a little bit batshit crazy.
I think even
as a kind of light touch of behavioral science and being aware of stuff like, you know, Richard Shotton's choice factory and the work in that is interesting. And it just seems to me that, and in fact, I remember talking to Richard Shotton and saying even things like terms like, say, the pratfall effects is the first that come to mind. Marketing and advertising folk have obviously known about that for years before it became a thing, because they studied human behavior. And so like someone like, oh, fuck knows, Avis. So like the classic Avis campaign that trades on what we now call the pratfall effect. But at the time, no one had given it that term. And so actually the study of humans and our behavior is, I would suggest, a core part of what we do.
Yeah, 100%. So we kind of say that all briefs are behavior change briefs, and all business problems are behavior change problems. So whether it's internal getting your, or it's with the customer, even if back to your earlier question around, you know, salience or just long-term impact, there's still behavior change. It's just the only delta that's different is time. So you're looking at future demand, not current demand. They're all behavior change problems. Framing it that way, I think, is useful, because then you focus on what you're trying to impact or the effect you're trying to have. You're not framing it in terms of, I've got to make a beautiful ad, or I've got to buy this media, or I've got to change my packaging. Keeping focused on what the end result is of what you want to happen is useful to cut through a lot of that bullshit.
Yeah, 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 totally. Adam, can I ask, how old were you roughly when you were looking through the DNAD annuals and enjoying what you saw?
I was 15. Okay. I was 14, 15, so...
And is there a reason why you didn't try and pursue it at that stage of life?
I probably didn't think I was good enough, which is kind of like, my sister was always the smart one, and she was very, 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 very scholastically smart, and I was all over the shop at school. It was not my finest hour. Somebody once said to me, mate, you're completely aimless, you know. And I thought back to that guy who said I should become a consumer psychologist, and I thought, right, I'm just going to double down and try to do that.
Is it too much of a stretch to say maybe she was a thinker and you were a tinker?
she was a thing. Yeah, bro. That's probably right. It's really interesting. Like, I do remember just being completely inspired, thinking I really want to do that one day. And I've never really kind of mentioned it, but I also just think I've never been able to do that. I can think that that's her domain. Fuck knows what I'm going to do. I was just lying down on the couch with my son just before I came in here. And he said to me, "Dad, do you ever feel like you wish you had achieved more?" And I just said to him, "Mate, I cannot believe what I've achieved. I so overread what I thought was going to happen in terms of my life. I can't believe what I've achieved. I'm incredibly grateful." And I think it's because I started off on a really low base where I just couldn't fucking put two sentences together, let alone think about getting a job and a career that I love.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a poignant question. A terrifying question as well, actually. The more I think about it, the more inadequate I feel. We're going to talk specifically about the perils, we're calling it, of listening to the customer. But before we do, how was that transition when you went from your time in a maximum security prison and the 6 years you spent there to Adland?
The transition was pretty smooth because I did it through my thesis. So I thought, what's the most commercialized aspect I can do of a thesis? And I did it on Cool, and that got me a job at a marketing consultancy called Added Value. The issue I had was I loved working in the prison system as well. When I was working in the marketing consultancy, I used to, on the weekend, go into the prisons and do court reports and in private practice. And so I was working 7 days a week, trying to blend these two careers for a few years. And then I was doing work still with Relationships Australia. And so I was trying to have two full-time careers at the same time, and I had to let one go. And I still would love to go back to the forensic setting. But once you do something like work in a prison or you've got an interesting story to say, then it's pretty easy to take that into an environment like advertising or marketing, because what we do is quite subjective. It suddenly makes you quite interesting. So I didn't have any issue transitioning, if you will, from forensic psychology to marketing or to consumer psychology. I was kind of welcomed with open arms.
Yeah. Cool. Nice. And did you find that your background gave you an advantage over people you worked with, or did you find that people were quite interested in human behavior? Like, because I come from it from a slightly, I mean, we're not dissimilar vintages, but I think you had a head start on me, is fair to say. And I was surprised when I started my career, for want of a better word, what a lack of research and kind of diagnosis and understanding of people there was. Now, that could just be a use case of one, and my route didn't take me via shops that had people who were more of your ilk.
Well, I found it interesting because I was always the psychologist. And so I had this kind of, you know, the reason why I like being called a psychologist is that psychology has got a really good brand. Like, as soon as you're a psychologist, people think you've got magical powers or whatever, and these amazing powers of insight. And so at one end, I was seen as an absolute expert, but at the other end, I was seen as really, really green and junior. And so it was kind of this kind of weird blend of being the expert in some bits of what I did, but completely naive in other bits. What I found really interesting was people used to say to me when I was in marketing, "Oh, psychology is just like marketing. Marketing is just like psychology, isn't it?" And I always used to say, "Nah, this is all like qualitative research and marketing. It's all just complete bullshit. It's all just completely made up. There's no science to it. There's no evidence to what we do. In call groups, just all over the place. It's got nothing to do with the rigor of the scientist practitioner model and being a CBT trained psychologist." And it wasn't until about 10 years later that behavioral economics made its way into marketing. And I can remember thinking at that time, "Oh, thank fuck. This is like psychology. This is the scientist practitioner model applied in a business setting or in a marketing setting that wasn't previously there." And so before behavioral economics came, it was this kind of complete dearth of You know, the Aaron Burr Bass Institute hadn't quite made the inroads it has today and so on.
Mm.
So it did feel like it was all bullshit. And behavioral economics and, you know, people like Rory, who championed it, has given marketing a whole new language and a way of, you know, and systems and processes to do evidence-based marketing, which wasn't there when I started. Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
There is really a tension, isn't there, which I'm not sure we'll ever be rid of marketing, advertising, being formulaic, as if you can study it as a science and there's absolute rules that are always true. Does that play a part in your point of the obsession we have with this kind of customer obsession and where you believe we're going wrong with it or where it's perhaps misinterpreted?
I might pull those two things apart. So where the customer obsession thing came from and the reason why it felt like bullshit was I used to do a lot of public speaking, and whenever I used to get, I still do, but whenever I get briefed on a brand going in there and they try to brief me, they always say, rule number, so I'll talk to me about the values and I could almost hear it and I'd say it as I said it, the customer, and I'd say, obsessed, you're fucking customer obsessed. And it just didn't ring true. Like, they weren't customer obsessed at all. And I was wondering why they were saying that and if they, and what proof points they had to be customer obsessed. The other thing that really struck me was when I used to work in marketing, even if it was all made up and all bullshit, at least there was some discipline to it. So if you worked for a company like Unilever back in the day, they'd give you their brand key and they'll say, here's our brand positioning and this is what our brand's all about. And at the same time as I was hearing all these people talk about how obsessed with the customer they were, you could start to see all these large organizations' understanding of what a brand is and the discipline behind brand strategy start to dissipate and fall away. It felt like the whole industry was on this seesaw. The more customer obsessed they became, the more they forgot about what their brand stood for and how to regulate and have governance and discipline around the brand and the brand strategy. And so my half-baked conclusion was that this customer obsession and really trying to understand the customer and organizations kind of just going, having this market orientation 100% towards the customer was beginning to be at the expense of having really good brand understanding. And therefore, if the customer need is at a category level, the customer need is not at a brand level. So customers do not need your brand, they need the category your brand exists in. So I'm thirsty, I need a drink, what drink do I buy? My car's just died, I need to buy a new car, what car do I buy? So it's the category need comes first and your brand has to fit into it. So if you're completely customer obsessed, you meet the needs of the category, and if you don't understand your brand within that, then you are a fast track to homogenization, which seems to be what seems to happen. So I would say the more you understand the consumer, then the more risk there is that you'll become a homogenized mess and will only be able to be distinctive by colors and logos and not be differentiated because you're meeting the needs of a category just like everyone else.
I don't put words in your mouth, but I'm taking that as it kind of pushes you towards treating your business as a someone that creates a commodity,
yeah,
rather than a brand. Right.
I think so. Yeah, I wouldn't quite put it like that, but I agree with the premise.
Yeah,
and you know, I do remember reading things like, I forget who wrote about lighthouse brands initially, but that was back in the day. But You know, really strong brands should be make it really easy for the consumer to understand what need you're fulfilling and what your brand stands for. And then you just pump that out into the world with clarity and people will be drawn towards it or they won't. But that to me is a much safer way to go rather than saying, oh, that person wants this, that person wants this, that person wants this. How do we meet all of our different needs? It's just too easy to take your eye off a ball of what's important.
Yeah, I think the words that stood out to me there, which I think will probably alarm some C-suite people, would be or they don't. Or they won't, sorry, you said. They'll be drawn to you or they won't. So maybe too many brands act as if they can, like, I don't know, appeal to everybody.
I worked with Coke for many years on and off, and I can remember ages ago getting briefed on Coke, and they started talking about the target market being a person of a particular age, of a particular gender, who had a particular attitude to life, who had a particular lifestyle, and they were very, very, very tight on their target consumer. And they made the brand appeal to that particular very, very tightly defined consumer. And I remember being in the room thinking, well, what about all the old people? What about all the other people who, what about the different gender who's not that gender of all those people? What are they going to do? And I just thought, well, of course they're going to still buy Coke just because they're not the being targeted for it. You know what I mean? So just because it's a clearly defined brand that stands for something very, very clear, and people buy it when they want it.
Yeah, especially a brand like Coca-Cola. I mean, many people would describe it as one of the most democratic brands out there in terms of it appealing to everyone, and it's just one of those lovely. But there's a quote somewhere. I'm not going to try and recall it because I'll get it wrong.
Andy Warhol.
It was just along the lines of, you know, the Coke that you and I can get is the same as the one the president can get, as in it's so democratic. There aren't like different scales of.
Yeah, that's an Andy Warhol quote. So the president and the bum on the street, I think were his words.
That's it.
Can still only buy the same cola. And I think his point was that capitalism is a socialist pursuit because it's a mass market game and therefore it's a leveler. I like that. I like thinking along those lines.
Yeah, it's nice. Where is there? I've used the word tension already, but I'm going to have to reach for it again because I'm a man of few words, as we'll become abundantly clear. But where is the tension between listening to the customer then and listening to your own brand?
I reckon the tension is what do you listen to first? So most brands are born from, if you're inventing a new product that is creating a new category, then listen to the customer, get a customer need, and create a whole new category out of that. So like being able to hire a car, no matter what city you're in, easily is a pretty cool thing to do. So that's a pretty good insight. So listening to the customer and the pain points around how to hire a car if I'm traveling around a lot. And then from there, you can invent a company called Uber, and then you can, you know, dominate the market because you've created a new category. So in that case, I'll say the consumer insight kind of comes first. But if you're a secondary player to in a market that already exists, I'll just have a really, really clear understanding of what my brand looks like, offers, is proposition, and then understand the rules of that category, which ones I'm going to adhere to, which ones I'm going to break, and be very, very clear about that. So then I'd weight my thinking more towards the brand and what I stand for and put it out in the world, knowing that I'm going to get a share of that particular category. I think it depends every time, but I think overall we weight ourselves too much to listening to the customer. And I think a lot of that got driven by the tech innovation and human-centered design and customer journey mapping and all of that kind of stuff, which didn't initially have anything to do with brand building. It had to do with tech innovation and stuff like that. And then brand builders took the wrong end of the stick, if you like, and started trying to apply it to themselves willy-nilly.
Yeah. They like doing that. I think the car example is wonderful. And if you rewind that, you know, as far as you can, there's that lovely quote of Henry Ford of if I asked the consumer what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse or something along those lines. And so actually in that instance, the customer research, diagnosis, insight, whatever word you want to use, actually led to him developing a new category.
That's right. I saw some research today for one of the ads we've done in Australia recently. We did an ad for a brand, and the research company researched and published the results as they were doing. And I said, oh, but the consumers found it irritating, and the type of attention was irritating. And I found that irritating because if that thought had been given to us, we may have had, in the development of that piece of communications, we may have had to change it, because you don't want the consumer to be irritated by your brand. But I have no idea if the consumer being irritated means they paid more attention to that piece of communications, whether they remembered it more, whether it would have a positive impact on sales or a negative impact on sales. The word irritated, consumers found that irritating. You think, oh, well, fuck, we better not do that then. And it could be completely the wrong thing to do. And that just happened today, a few hours ago. And so these kind of things of the consumer voice hacking away at strong brands happens all the time, where strong brands with weak brand management, people just listen to the various customers or the various cohorts or the various bits of research they're doing. And that's when it starts to chip brands away. And, you know, that's where you get the advertising.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, and I'm going to try not to open a can of worms or historic worms, because this is a kind of debate that I've had on this pod and off it for years and years. And my take on that would be that if you had to choose between irritating and indifferent, you'd go for irritating simply because you're noticed and the consumer knows who you are. Although I accept that there's all sorts of flaws to that argument in the detail. But you're right, I think, and that's where I think it's really important to recognize, and you'll be able to recognize it far better than I can and most people in the industry, that because human beings are messy, you really need to be quite cautious with how you interpret research or feedback or surveys or claim data. Like, there's just you can kind of massage it to go whichever way you want, and maybe irritating actually versus whatever the category norm is and the competitors is being noticed.
One of the issues is if you do research, it costs you $100,000 and takes 2 months and is delivered online, then everyone feels obligated to listen to every word of that piece of research. And so it's the sunk cost into the research creates a problem as well. So there's new research methodologies that are more fluid, they're faster and cheaper, and there's less sunk costs. And so therefore, I think businesses can listen to the research and the insights with a lightness of touch that they weren't necessarily able to do before. And so I do think the research industry is catching up and getting better in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I like lightness of touch. I think that's better than my idea of being cautious of what the research is saying. That's a bit more respectful, I suppose, to the intel. Funny enough, I really, really like Susan Coghill, who heads up the tourism.
Yeah, she's great. She's unreal.
She's wonderful. And when she talked about her Good Day campaign, we specifically tried to unpick a lot of the reaction from, well, people who weren't the target market. So, Aussies who live in Australia versus the success that the campaign ultimately had. And that was a really interesting point, because I think we probably visited something similar where the objective wasn't for local Australians to like the campaign. It simply had to work. And I think that's where subjectivity can kind of take people down wrong turns and so on and so forth.
Yeah, 100%, especially big words like liking things and irritability and stuff. And at the end of the day, they can all just be different types of red herrings taking you off track. But, and I just want to caveat all of this with saying, I do think you need good market orientation. So I'm not saying we shouldn't try to understand the consumer or whatever, but it's just more of a case of degrees that it's gotten a fair bit out of whack. And that's the only point I want to say.
Yeah. No, I'm pleased you've qualified that. And I have heard you talk on this before, Adam. I think you're very good at making that point. Like, it's too easy, and, you know, marketing, Twitter and LinkedIn will probably go to their graves arguing about so much kind of intricacies or absolutes that weren't ever intended. So
yeah, 100%.
I'm mindful that it's about 12 minutes past what the fuck in Sydney at the moment. So I'm going to go to listener questions now. That's good with you. I didn't mean to keep you so long. We've had a really good one from someone who's obviously a long-time listener, Debbie, because she refers to an episode that was about 4 years ago. On a previous episode, Richard Huntington talked on being interesting. Does that get lost in the incessant distinct versus different marketing debates, or is it part of both?
What a good question. And many years ago, I read a book by Edward de Bono called How to Be More Interesting. A couple of the things it said was about don't ever be the first to change the topic in a conversation, that the more interesting person will stay with the topic. That's one of a few things I remember on this book. And I once asked Edward if he wrote a book on how to be more interesting, does that make him the most interesting person in the world? And his point of view was, no, it's just like a Formula One racing car engineer. He knew how to design the car, but he didn't know how to drive it. And so,
okay, nice. I like that.
Yeah. So that was his thing. I do think it matters whether something can be interesting, but still not be branded. And if it's not branded, and let's just say that's distinctive, right? So if distinctiveness is turning up as a brand turning up as itself, something can be really, really interesting, not at all branded, not at all distinctive, and be a complete waste of money. And you see that a lot today still in marketing communications. I would rather be bland and branded than interesting and not branded, because if it's not branded, it's not distinctive, then everything's a complete waste of money, no matter how interesting it is.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. Absolutely. You can't attribute it. Katie's asked a simple one, presumably on the wonderful agency that is Thinkabell. How do you measure magic? Is there a funnel? I don't know if that's tongue-in-cheek or not.
So we have a B4 measurement model that's overly between us, a bit overly complicated. But we look at breadth, which is marketing inputs. We look at behavioral measures. We look at brand measures. And then we look at business measures. And then we have 1,000 different plugins at all of those different things. And we track it. We track, you know, what sentiment's like. We track how much we're in the media. We've tracked our NPS since we started. Started 11, is now around 50. We measure it all. So that's one point. So thank you for letting me say that. I've never been asked that before. The other point is we have an interesting model, which is a thinker-tinker model. So every client has a core thinker and a core tinker who run that piece of work, and then which is like a strategy CT type and a creative production type person. Those two are hand in glove, and that's the core relationship in the business. And then around those people, they all have a squad, and the squad is just made up of various other people who can help those two solve that client's problem or work with that client or whatever the project might be. But what I'd like to do is like to get more data around the effectiveness of the thinker-tinker model as opposed to the agency as a whole. And so that's kind of a project we're looking at the moment.
Nice. Amazing. I'm trying not to draw parallels because I shouldn't and it would be wrong of me. But as an agency, we similarly are a team of just strategists and creatives. But then again, a lot of the work we do, I mean, everything is brand positioning and that brand articulation. So I'm listening with envy of that model.
Yeah, no,
it's so brutally simple.
And you absolutely 100% should be making analogies to your own business. And one of the things your guests get out of being on your show I'm talking to you is that they get to learn as well. I like it when you do that. And I think in the strategy space, having a really core person with a kind of a design eye and a really good strategist, and just putting those two people together, they can solve the biggest strategic problems. You know what I mean? It's just amazing us watching two people who those two skill sets complement each other really well, just being able to monster a massive brand project. It's cool.
Yeah, 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 wonderful. Amazing. Thanks for adding that, Adam. The final part of the interview then is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests, starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Pitching. So this is big advice for anybody starting out in their career or their life. It's something that nobody fucking tells you or nobody fucking told me, and that's fit in. Stop trying to be fucking different. Just learn the rules of a game and work out how to be like everyone else and work out how to get along and not be a cock. And I think once you fit in, then you can stand out. And the parallel for brand building is, if you're completely different, you're going to be fucked. You have to play, you have to understand the category you're operating in, and then you can zig while other people are zagging, but only if you're zigging within the zag. So fit in.
Love it. And then stand out. I love it. I love it. Our employee contracts have a clause which is simply says, don't be a dick. We all know what that means.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great.
Nice. Love it. Number two is, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
I'd banish purpose-driven scam work that's got no relationship to sales. And so it still irritates me a lot when you see it. That's a pretty safe, silly answer.
Yeah, well, it's a good answer. Lots of listeners will know I've been on a one-man crusade to highlight the hypocrisy of Cadbury's Mondelez marketing for some time. The issue is, given they, you know, my tiny, tiny independent agency pays more business taxes than theirs, which I find truly upsetting. If when they're trading on brand purpose, the whole like donate my fucking chocolate bar, whatever it is, to help Age UK charities, when actually they paid like 0.2% of the taxes they should have done. And I have particular beef with them, and I shouldn't be using this episode to voice it, so I'll stop now. But I do 100% agree with the hypocrisy. Like, fine, get away without paying your taxes, but then don't pretend that you're, you know, something other than that.
Yeah.
Right.
Good. Have you seen this article in The Guardian floating around the internet at the moment around superficial purpose-driven brands and the superficial wokeness of brands and the vacuum that's created? There's an interesting thought piece by... Anyway.
I'll dig it out.
Yeah.
I'll dig it out and I'll link to it in this episode if you're good with that. So aside from stop listening to your customers and the advertising effect, how to change behavior, which are linked to in this episode, and I encourage everyone to check those out. Are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I think anything by a guy called Irvin Yalom is, and so Irvin Yalom's a psychiatrist, and his early books were Love's Execution or Other Tales of Psychotherapy, Existential Psychotherapy. He's amazing, but he's just written a book called Here and Now. I think it's called Tales from the Heart. Tales from the Here and Now, something like that. And he's now got Alzheimer's, and so he can only see patients for an hour, and he only sees them once, because after that he can't remember them. And so the whole book is just these various vignettes of the hour he has with these people. And what he tries to do to change their behavior in that hour, or help them, is he looks at the patterns that are occurring in that hour between the two of them. And he says, well, if this is happening in our therapeutic relationship right now, then this is probably how you're acting with everybody you interact with and you meet. So in that hour, he's trying to get the insight, feed it back to the person so they have the insight to be aware of their own behavior that they can then do something about. And it's fucking unreal. It's a really, really cool concept, and it's a really good book.
That is an awesome concept. And it's rare, because we're on 160 odd episodes. It's rare for a book to come up that hasn't featured before, but that certainly hasn't. So that will also be linked. Amazing. Great recommendation. And the number four is, we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honor, depending on your view, to our guest, who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode, Adam?
I reckon probably the comment that the person said the most to me is a woman called Anne Young, who was my supervisor as a psychologist. And she said, never get more excited about the prospect of change than your client. So you always have to lead by behind and never try to convince them into changing or get excited about change. And I love that concept. So I'll dedicate this episode to Anne Young, who was a psychologist at Bathurst Correctional Centre, and I've no idea what Anne's up to now.
Nice. Amazing. What a great quote. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to Anne Young, and we'll weave those words into this episode's listing as well, because I want to read them again. Brilliant. So as a final call to action, everyone listening can head over to the usual places. You'll find links to everything discussed, to all of the books. I'm going to throw in a few of Adam's talks, which I've enjoyed over the years. But how else can they get more of you?
Maybe just on, the books, LinkedIn, the Black T-Shirts podcast. So I do that with a guy called Brent Smart, is the CMO of Telstra. That talks about XXL creativity in business. And just via just have a look at our work on Thinkabell and that kind of stuff.
Nice. Super easy. Love it. Thank you, Adam. Listen, I can't thank you enough for joining us. I think you know, but if not, you are someone I've admired for years. So I was slightly full of trepidation coming into this, which rarely happens these days. I'm 6 years into this, but you do come across people you admire and think, shit, I hope I don't say anything dumb. I definitely have done, but I don't care because I've enjoyed it. So thank you.
That's right. That's incredibly kind of you. And thank you. And thanks for inviting me on. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, mate. Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pods. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. Can't get no call to action, but I try. Yeah!